Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. Hi, friends. I have what I think will be a really interesting interview for you today. Vashon is full of creative people running really interesting businesses. And I'm always amazed when I discover one and I think, dang, that is so interesting. So when I met Steve Richman, I at the farmer's market, he was manning a table, giving out a lot of great free information. I was struck by what an interesting business he had as a mobile service working, helping islanders and King County to preserve their land and eradicate invasive weeds and maintain their properties. Did I get that right, Steve?
Yes, that sounds correct.
More or less. And then when I dug into his background a little more, it was fascinating, as a lot of our paths are. It wasn't linear. So I'm going to ask him in a minute to tell us about his career. But first of all, it's a service that you're providing that's incredibly needed. Because as a former master gardener, I know how many people grapple with invasive weeds. A lot of people have large properties here, and not many of us have the body power to hand weed the weeds that can come in so rapidly and so invasively. And I also know that it's a field and occupation that requires thinking out complex issues. At the same time, it requires a lot of manual labor, because I used to, I worked with as a consultant with an environmental engineering organization, and they were always faced with these non-black and white decisions. You know, for example, one that really struck me was they were charged with protecting endangered species in the east of the mountains. And at the same time, they were charged with creating the roads that the fire service needed to protect the mountains from wildfires in a very planful way. And as I heard about it, I was struck. There's no easy answer. If you build those roads, you're going to destroy wildlife habitat. And at the same, so you're going to hurt the endangered species, but if you let the whole mountain burn, you're also going to endanger the wildlife. So where's the easy answer? Another really tough one that's, you know, got a lot of, engenders a lot of feeling in this area is marine mammals, because they're protected. There's a Marine Mammal Act. But when you see one of the sea lions at the Ballard Locks sitting there thinking it's free lunch and they can have all the salmon they want to eat, you realize, well, the salmon also deserve some protection, and we do try and protect them. So which comes first, the marine mammal or trying to keep the salmon flow? So that is all background to say that when it comes to Mother Nature, it's complex. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to share some ideas about how you might think about invasives in your backyard. But first, Steve, I was so struck. Can you give me a cameo of your background? Because it wasn't linear. You haven't always been an invasive weed specialist. And how did you get to what you're doing now?
That's a big question. Thank you, Sally, for airing my concerns first. But I started not knowing what I wanted to do in life. Got a business degree of all things, and realized I was actually in love with photography, and I became a news photographer. And that took me, along with volleyball, actually took me traveling to the former Soviet Union on a volleyball team And I was a photographer at the time, so I wanted to work internationally. And I had offers to work to do war photography, but I decided I couldn't do that. I wouldn't do that to my parents. So at the same time, I was becoming aware of global warming and environmental concerns and realized I knew nothing about nature. Even though I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, I knew more than I realized just having hiked a lot. But I came back from my photography career and travel career, changed everything I did and worked toward getting to know plants, working for nurseries and landscapers. And eventually I realized native plants were important. So I took a native plant stewardship course. And in exchange for that course, I did some volunteerism. And I finally got a job working in the woods, controlling invasives and planting native plants.
In Washington State?
Yes, here in King County. In Seattle. The owners of the company were a couple of guys from Earth Corps, which is a good program, teaches young kids how to do the work. And they were the first private company that actually did this work. I was the second, and I'm right now the oldest standing restoration company in King County that I'm aware of. And so I'm sort of the grandfather of this new field, how to control invasives, do it carefully, make the trade-offs, what we call best practices, and navigate all those concerns that we're concerned about the orcas and the salmon, and we're also concerned about native birds and so forth. And, we've come a long way. Our practices have evolved, and we're getting more efficient all the time. So my goal is to share my 20 years of experience with the general public to see if we can get these invasives under control, because it is a perpetual epidemic.
A perpetual epidemic. That's so interesting. I just want to let people know I'm talking with Steve Richmond, who has a company done on bicycle.
Yes.
You travel by bicycle.
Yes.
And the name of your company is?
Garden Cycles.
Garden Cycles, that is focused on landscape restoration or landscape, or how would you define it more?
We call ourselves ecological restoration.
Ecological restoration. And we're just beginning, tip of the iceberg, to talk about some of the challenges and some of the trade-offs. And I know, folks, I invite you to really listen, because it's easy to get black and white when it comes to environmental restoration or really anything to do with the environment. But as Steve just reminded us, it is complex. You have many good things that people may want to do, and they don't always fit together. So it's a challenge. And I'm fascinated to know that it is now a field that's research backed and has, you know, is developing as a place of study and practice, because a lot of us do it by the seat of our pants.
that's true with all gardeners. There's a lot of ways to skin a cat.
A lot of ways to skin a cat, but it is tough. And you know, I became a master gardener when I moved to the island, so I have some knowledge of this, but every day I face it at home, because, and I think a lot of us do, you know, we have an island where many of us are over 50. A lot of us have 5 or 10 acre properties, and the invasives are going to be there, but we don't have young bodies and we don't have infinite time. And some of us don't have infinite resources.
Right.
You know, if I had my way, I would go out and hire a team of 10, and they would pull out every darn piece of lamium, that beautiful mint-like, silver-gray, lovely plant that consumes our forest floors, especially on Maury. But I don't have those.
Right.
I sit and ponder, and I wonder, what the heck can I do? Because I know what I don't want to do, but I'm not sure what I do want to do. What are the worst invasives people are dealing with here on the island?
Well, I'm sorry to hear that you have yellow archangel.
Yeah, that's what it's called popularly. It's tough, but when I was a master gardener, I learned that it is way invasive on Maury.
Yeah.
And, you know, the hard part too, Steve, is that I can try and eradicate, but my neighbor's grown it.
Correct.
And my neighbor's neighbor has grown it, and it's down the road as well. Yeah. And I mean, the best that I could do is this year I took a weed whacker when it was in bloom, because I don't want the seeds going. It doesn't mean I've won the battle. But the birds are very willing to spread those invasives that you have worked so hard to control.
And that's what we call seed rain. Invasive seeds raining down by bird. And
I love that seed rain.
Yeah.
It's, so it sounds kind of poetic, you know.
So I have a website called seedrain.org that explains those trade-offs and best practices and how homeowners might address their own invasives. So you back to your question of what invasives do we have on island that are a problem? My top two, well, holly, as I'll start with, because it's doubling every 6 years.
Oh my gosh.
That's an exponential spread.
Yeah.
And is projected to be our dominant tree species in 3 decades. Given that exponential spread.
You're on the island.
You're on the island. And that's because we have so many holly in private yards with lots of sun. So there's heavy seed production.
Mm.
And then the birds drop them in the woods. And you think that holly must be good bird food. But when holly gets to be so dense, you only have wildlife food at one time of the year. So what we need is diversity. And we need native plant diversity. So butterfly bush is a great example of 700 native butterfly species in North America. Only one will lay their eggs on butterfly bush. So the butterflies like the flowers, but if you don't have the larva, you don't have butterflies. So that's an example of how useless non-native plants are.
And it's also an example, I understand there was a holly farm once on the island.
A number of them,
were they? You know, so pretty for Christmas, have the little red berries and stuff. And I remember a friend gifting me a butterfly bush years ago because we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't on the island, but it's a pretty bush. You know, it grows a lot in the Maury Beach Park area.
Right.
Scotch broom was introduced, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And Himalayan blackberries. Somebody thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
And it met many of the criteria, but failed at others and then liked us too much.
Right. It loves our mild climate.
Mm.
I've also planted some invasives early in my career.
Really? Which ones?
Knotweed.
You planted knotweed?
That was my first
job. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I grew up with it. It was in my mom's backyard. And I've been working on that for 20 years, pulling it.
In her backyard. Oh, my God.
And it has not worked by hand because it evolved in volcanic soils, and it keeps coming up through those soils. So the roots are 10 feet deep.
Oh, my gosh.
So you can't uproot 10 feet of soil, particularly in streamside riparian, situations where you have salmon habitat. You have to carefully navigate all those concerns to get rid of it, because knotweed, where it's established, detracts 60% of the bugs that feed the salmon fingerlings.
Oh my gosh.
So if we neglect it, we're going to lose our habitat for salmon.
So here's one of those folks that Steve Richman is telling us about where they just illustrate the complexity, because this is not a plant you can hand pull. You can't pull out 10 feet of roots. And worse, when you start hand pulling it, you're likely to either disturb the soil or leave most of the roots underground where it's just going to come back.
Yeah.
And when you let it go, because I lived for a few years on Thornton Creek in Seattle, when you let it go, it will overtake the streamside. And I didn't realize the impact on salmon habitat. So it's not one that you can turn your back on. I mean, truthfully, if I don't weed that lamium for a couple of years, it spreads crazy, but nobody gets hurt, as far as I know. But knotweed kills. Knotweed diminishes the possibility of salmon restoration.
Well, Sally, you mentioned soil disturbance.
Yes.
And the erosion that results from that uprooting manually, you lose your topsoil. And your topsoil is a sponge and filter for stormwater. Stormwater is basically runoff during a rainstorm, runoff from your roofs, roads, driveways that carries toxins into Puget Sound. And those toxins bioaccumulate into salmon and then orcas and people who eat salmon.
Oh.
So the issue is not that we have arsenic in our soil on island. I mean, it's fairly dilute in most places, but when it bioaccumulates, that's the problem. So we have to protect our soil.
Okay, so let me, but you mentioned the arsenic word, which is a big scary word when I moved onto the island, especially being on Maury. But you're saying that the topsoil is actually a protective layer for us?
It reduces flooding. Mm. So it is indeed a sponge. The first sponge is vegetation. Mm. Evergreen vegetation is twice as good as deciduous, maples and alders, for example. So we want our evergreen conifers, and we want them not just to intercept stormwater, but also to shade out weeds and shade out the reinvasions. So if you have evergreen trees, evergreen shrubs, and evergreen ground covers, you're going to reduce the reinvasion rate, and you'll have a chance to get ahead of the weeds, basically by recreating a forest.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you can't, or can you, maybe you could, but plant a Doug Fir streamside to protect, you know, to eradicate the knotweed. It doesn't, that's not one that works, right?
Yeah, it doesn't work. It doesn't shade out the knotweed.
Yeah. But you're saying, yeah, if I understand that even someone who said, okay, well, let's just take off this top level of soil and we'll get the darn knotweed out. You go, no. Mm-hmm. You're exposing the ground in ways that are just going to create more problems.
Right.
And you probably won't eradicate the knotweed.
Yeah. All soil has just tiny amounts of air pollution, also smelter pollution and whatever runoff comes from our cars and roads and so forth. So we really can't disturb it. We want to leave it intact, and we want it to basically sequester those toxins.
Mm.
And the trick to sequestering toxins and filtering toxins is having wood in the ground. So if you're uprooting everything, you're actually uprooting the roots that are going to feed the microbes and the fungi that filter those toxins.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mentioned evergreenness. The other main concept in restoration is wood. We have a saying, wood is good.
Oh.
Not just as mulch on top of the soil, but in the soil. So preventing uprooting of roots is important. And then somehow if you're planting, you can actually get a little wood into your planting hole and you'll have a sponge underground that attracts mycelium, and that mycelium actually feeds the plants water and nutrients.
Interesting. The wood is also acidifies the soil, doesn't it? So does that assume that the plants that you're planting like that acid?
The native plants are adapted to our native soils.
Okay. And yeah.
So they don't need as much water, although their first couple of years, they benefit from water. Yeah. And they will spread better if you do water them and baby them their first couple of years.
But they like the wood.
The duff in the forest, duff. The forest floor, yes.
I love it too. I love
it
too.
Yeah, smells great.
Yeah, I'm talking today with Steve Richmond about ecological restoration and his company, which is called
Garden Cycles.
Yeah. Well, I remember when, and it was kind of a bittersweet experience when King County used to allow people interested in native plants to go harvest native plants before they gave over lands to developers.
I've done it. I've loved it.
Yeah. Well, it was a great opportunity. And I mean, it was really exciting, except when I thought about, oh my gosh, this is so lush. I mean, you'd have 2 feet of topsoil and it was all that duff and woody and just gorgeous. I mean, I wanted to take bags of dirt just out of the forest.
That's some of the most valuable things, is it? Not just the plants.
Not just the plants.
But mycelium.
Yes.
The microbes.
And, but I wasn't in any position to haul, you know, tons of dirt. And we were just invited in to take out the plants. But it was a wonderful opportunity and a bit tragic because I knew what was coming and that those forests would never be again. Mm-hmm. But I have this thing about lush. you know, deep forest, you know, soil, because it's just so beautiful.
I love those salvage events. I consider them to be like Christmas.
Are they still doing them?
I haven't heard of one lately.
I didn't think so. Yeah. I didn't think so. So now we're going to get into the place where I know these are fighting words for people, because I think there are people who would prefer no herbicides at all. No herbicides, or maybe allow you to use a little vinegar on your, you know, weeds at home, which if you don't know what you're doing, and most of us do not, is probably best practice. Because there's a difference between using a herbicide very tactfully, very knowledgeably, and very sparsely, you know, only when and where it's needed. And, you know, a home gardener who doesn't know what she's doing, just applying them fairly casually, which is why they're often restricted. But when we hear about that, we think, oh my God, toxic, kill the environment, this is really bad, blah, blah, blah. And so I want to distinguish, and I hope you'll be willing to help us distinguish, why very, very thoughtful, planful, tactical, environmentally sensitive use of certain herbicides is actually a good thing.
Well, I don't want to promote herbicides.
No, no, I know, but you're not.
But
I'm not
for
asking
those people that are considering it.
And let me just give you one. This is a sidebar, because I was thinking about this on the way in. Fentanyl is horrible. Fentanyl causes huge deaths when used inappropriately, but in a very controlled hospital setting, fentanyl can save lives. It can reduce pain. But the problem, of course, is it got into the wrong hands, and it became, and so you hear the word fentanyl, you think, oh my God, it's so horrible. But you go, no, in a very reduced way, it has a purpose, but it has to be very controlled and very, you know, medically aware. I think there's kind of an equivalent that it, you know, there are substances that in the wrong hands could do huge damage, but in the hands of somebody who is certified, knowledgeable, controlled in application, it's a completely different thing.
Yes, and I have read the research and have made the trade-offs and carefully use two herbicides that King County allows us to use on their projects, which is imazapyr and triclopyr. But again, I don't want to promote it. I want to encourage people to do their own research and either accept the risks for use on their own property, or make the trade-offs for those risks and make an informed decision. I do have a layperson's explanation of why we use herbicide on seedgrain.org, and it has links to a lot of the science, including links to the resources that physicians use when they're researching something. They have an AI summary of various issues in the environment or in human health. And I've actually worked with a physician, and they weren't comfortable with certain herbicides, but the ones that I used, they actually thought that was the best choice. So we do make those trade-offs, and we do apply the herbicide in the right time of year. So before I say anything else, your best option is to hire an experienced person who can actually teach you the right timing of the year, which is typically fall, because that's when the sap is flowing to the roots. So you actually piggyback on the sap flow, and you often will cut and treat a holly or a blackberry and just paint it on the fresh cut, and you'll see it draw down into the roots, into the stem, and go to the roots. So
tell me that again. I never knew that. And I think what you're saying, I'm going to underscore it, because from my little master gardener background, I did remember that timing is everything.
Yes.
That something can be very effective, but only if used at the right time of year.
Right.
So I didn't realize that fall was the time when we were most likely to be able to stop the growth of holly. And
yeah, so holly, if you cut it, will re-root. So if you're going to do it without herbicide, don't cut it low, because you'll get root suckers. So cut it up high so you can continually break off those new shoots and eventually starve the plant. But when you have 5 acres of dozens, if not hundreds, of holly, then you might it's a matter of scale. You might want to hire a professional to come in and inject, which you can do any time of year. You can actually use this injection tool that is intravenous, and it will kill the holly in about 3 to 4 months. But if you're using a cut and treat method, you do want to glove up. I use nitrile gloves. And you don't want to do it in the spring, because if you cut the stem for a blackberry, for example, it will actually self-rinse. You'll see the sap ooze up, and it will rinse off the herbicide, and you won't get it into the root. So spring flush, when everything is leafing out, all that sap's going up. And so it doesn't really turn the corner until it fully leafs out, and then it's photosynthesizing, and then it starts to take carbs down to the roots. At that point, you can cut and treat it and watch it draw down. So if you're cutting blackberry, say, in July, and some of them might self-rinse, some of them might draw down, you might want to wait a couple of weeks. But if you wait until August, the blackberry might be drought dormant, and it won't absorb then. So fall, when you get more dew, there's more water going through the foliage and actually then going down to the roots to get ready for the next spring flush. That's when the sap is going down. That's when you can cut and treat. But you really want to avoid rain. You don't want it to rinse off and become an issue, because what you can buy at the hardware store is not actually the safer herbicide that licensed people like myself can buy.
Interesting.
So they have surfactants that are actually more risky to the environment. Sometimes surfactants are actually more toxic than the herbicide itself.
Interesting. I'm talking to Steve Richmond, whose company does environmental restoration. You're teaching me stuff. I mean, this is complex. I've been cutting my blackberries. Now, blackberries can be dug up.
They can be, with a lot of soil damage. But if you leave root fragments, they'll come back.
Aww.
And now, instead of one or two stems, you're going to have six or seven stems that are harder to get rid of. So the trick for blackberry is, again, evergreenness. You can shade out blackberry and Scots broom.
Uh-huh.
So if you do pull it up manually, mulch it. Mulch that disturbed soil so you reduce the runoff.
Interesting.
So you don't get the weed vacuum just attracting new weeds, because we have weeds everywhere.
We have weeds everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, this is so interesting. So we've talked about knotwood, blackberry, holly, and we haven't talked about ivy.
Yes, that's the worst.
Oh, is it?
It is. And the reason is ivy will grow in the shade of an intact forest, our regional forest.
An upper forest.
Yeah. Yeah, our regional forests west of the Cascades are actually threatened by ivy. It's not a sensational wildfire, but it's a slow incremental spread that is not stopping. So I look at Seattle's urban forest, which was the epicenter of ivy introductions, and it took 100 years to cover literally 50% of Seattle's forest. Just dense ivy. Nothing. You just look around, you're in certain areas and it's up the trees and it's on the ground. We don't see it on the ground as much on Vashon Island because we have so many deer and they actually browse the ivy. They actually hide the extent of it. So when you see it up a tree, normally you would see ivy on the ground too, but the deer are actually eating it on the ground and half, 4 or 5 feet up the tree. So the deer also will. Well, let me stay on ivy and the reason it's such a threat. I asked a WSU professor how many years it would take ivy to get entrenched into our regional forests. And, I told him I thought it would be 100 years. He says, no, I think it'll be about 50. And that's because suburbia has spread and there's ivy everywhere. And so if it gets entrenched into our regional forests, it's very hard to get rid of. Mm-hmm. A lot of soil damage. It will affect timber industries, it'll affect fisheries industries, ecotourism, and ivy basically will shut down the regeneration of native forests. So if you don't have the trees and the duff and the pollinator habitat of that diversity, we will change everything region wide, and that's a health concern. Ivy is notorious rat habitat. You have a food source like blackberry or rotting tree fruit, and the cover of ivy is where rats like to nest, you're going to have other issues.
Amazing.
So we have to nip it in the bud.
At the Vashon Farmers Market, and I really suggest, folks, that you go and walk this summer while Steve Richman is going to be there with his table, giving so much useful free information and also referring people to his one of his websites, which is free and contains a lot of information. And
seedrain.org.
It's called seedrain.org. I'll put that in the show notes. You had something that looked to me like it, the branch of a Doug fir, but it was actually ivy.
It was the largest one I've cut here on island.
I couldn't believe it.
Up above Burton. It was a monster. It was up a 120-foot Douglas fir, and I had to use a chainsaw, which I don't recommend because you don't want to cut the bark.
Right.
But this one, I had to use a chainsaw to get it off. It was, I don't know, 7-8 inches in diameter. And
it was like a tree.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
When you cut it, does the ivy, can it leach minerals out of the bark, or does it depend on its own roots in the soil?
Ivy's an interesting plant, being a vine.
Yeah.
And so in the summer, the tree that it's climbing on is sucking all the water out of the soil. So it's really not growing a lot in the summer. And it starts to grow during the fall rains, and it's taking moisture from dew and rain and concentrating it typically in a maple, which is a big funnel. And so it will actually glean that water coming down the trunk. And it's almost an epiphytic plant at that point. And then when it gets enough moisture in the vines, it will set seed in the winter. So the most important thing you can do, and now is the time to do it, is to cut the ivy in a circle all the way around the tree. And it will dry up in the top of the tree, and it won't go to seed.
When you say a circle, when I see ivy, I just usually see a vine going up. So what's the circle?
Yeah, well, if you have vines that are completely around the entire circumference.
Cut it. It disconnects from its roots.
Yes. And you can make two cuts if you want, because sometimes they'll regraft. Make one down low to the ground and make one at chest height where it's easy. But typically I only do one cut because I'm just moving for speed, and I'll just make sure that vine is not close to regrafting. I'll just move it around, or typically I'll actually put herbicide on it in the fall, so it'll kill that root, because that vine will actually keep coming back and becomes what I call a forever problem.
Oh.
On island, the deer might help you starve that plant and browse the new leaves, and it might eventually die that way. If you keep an eye on it and the deer browse it,
right,
you can starve it without herbicide. But professionally, if you want a professional to come in, we might even inject the larger ivy vines with a tool called an EasyJect Lance.
Wow.
And that works. It's effective, and it's very targeted, and it doesn't leach if you do the right rate, you don't overapply.
Right.
So that's the skill of restoration, is knowing what plants are good, which ones are bad, which ones to go after, and not over applying herbicide.
No.
The typical homeowner uses 5 times what they should use with the herbicide.
Interesting. Interesting.
So yeah, if you're lucky enough to find an experienced practitioner, they can teach you a lot on their property, even if you only get them on one day.
I was going to ask you that. Do you do like one-day consultations, or do you...
I don't really do consultations, because I really can't look at a site and know it well just with a one-day visit. I need to work it and see the soil, see the hydrology, where's the water flowing, see what other invasives you have. And at that point, I do what I call coaching, and I'll tag the plants so you know what they are. I'll give you some tricks. I'll show you cut and treat techniques if you want to do that. But if you don't, that's my service, is to handle the herbicide for clients.
Right.
So they don't have to touch it. And I'm comfortable. I'm careful with it. I'm always using eye protection and gloves. On the rare occasions that I do spray, I actually use a respirator. But I also use a respirator for diesel exhaust, which is much worse than anything.
Could you ride a bicycle?
Yeah, I do.
So you're helping the environment that way. And yeah. What about our banks? Because there are a lot of...
Our steep slopes.
Steep slopes on Vashon.
Yes.
That's tough, isn't
that it? That is very tough. And most practitioners will make you sign a disclaimer because you're inviting them to come and help your slope. But you could have a landslide on the precipice of happening, and just keep being on a slope could cause a landslide. So you want to avoid being on a slope between Halloween and April Fools. So when the slope is wet in the winter, you want to avoid soil disturbance. So you do most of your work before Halloween, and then you'll put down erosion fabric after you remove some invasives. You don't want to get too crazy too fast, because if you do too much, you could cause issues. So incrementally, you need to remove invasives carefully, and it needs to be by professionals, and you should really have a geotech and a soil science person out there that will tell you what sort of soils you have, whether they're prone to landslides or whether there's a history of landslides, whether you need retaining walls or pin piles for your house. That's a whole field that I'm really
that
not,
is a yeah. big field, and yeah. we have a lot of steep slopes, and unfortunately, I remember a person I knew over on Melcher Way who got too close to his
yes.
slope.
Yes, and I worked on in that same bluff 3 days ago.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah,
we'll talk about that.
I stayed away from
interest.
That edge.
Yeah, that edge. Yeah. Really hard. Well, how do you sustain yourself? How do you restore Steve Richmond? Because this is hard physical work, and it's also time sensitive. You know, there's certain times when your work is in big demand, and there's only one of you. And
So,
how do you restore you?
Well, I love working for myself because I set my own schedule according to my body's recovery. I do have an athletic background. I love beach volleyball.
Yeah, I guess you were really good at it once upon a time.
Once upon a time, I was pretty good.
But yeah.
I'm no longer really able, though. In my mind, I would like to play, but my passion and mission in life is to control invasives, and I can't do both. So
right.
I do rest. I'll work maximum 3 days a week. And my rest days, I'm doing my paperwork, eating, sleeping. But now, as I'm at retirement age, 2 days a week is usually what I can handle.
Well, you gotta replicate yourself, Steve, because we have a lot. These issues are going to be with us for years, we need a new generation of folks who are savvy and skilled and experienced.
And that's why I wrote seedrain.org. It has a how-to step-by-step guide. If you study that and internalize it, you will know more than most landscapers. So it's a real resource, and it's a combination. It's not just physical work, which it is, but you have to understand chemistry of the herbicides you're using. You have to understand geology and hydrology, the types of soils, and certainly you have to know your plants and the habitats they like to grow in. So. Yeah, I wanted to just touch back on the slope restoration. Geotechs are the first step, but often they will recommend what they call vegetative management. So getting the shallow-rooted ivy, not necessarily out, but treated. You don't want to uproot anything on a slope, but then planting the deeper-rooted plants, the native plants that handle those soils. And those plants in their roots will actually weave together and hold the soil. Sword fern is one of the workhorses for the ground covers. Low Oregon grapes, another one. Salal is great, but then you need your shrubs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not want too much evergreenness on a slope, because you want to get a certain amount of light to your sword ferns so they actually set root. So you have to manage your sunlight as well. But I diverted. So what was your last question?
Oh, how you're going to replicate you.
Oh, that website. But I actually have given some seminars to landscapers I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to mentor people. I have a, someone wants to get into the business, I have a little summary of how to actually start your own business. But the first step is to probably apprentice with an established restoration company that does mm-hmm. this work and see if you like it. Right. So start volunteering. That's how I started.
Yeah.
And know your plants.
Yeah. Well, I thank you so much for your time. You have just opened my mind to the importance of what you're doing, because a lot of us, when we think about caring for the environment, think about, you know, I should recycle, you know, and I need to limit my, you know, carbon use. But this is a whole arena that is absolutely here and critical to the environment, but requires knowledge. And so thank you so much for bringing that to the community.
Thank you, Sally.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.